Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 3 of our In Your Nature podcast. I'm Niall Hatch.
And I'm Ricky Whelan. This podcast is brought to you by Birdwatch Ireland, Laois and Offaly County Councils, and the Keep Well campaign, an initiative of the Government of Ireland with funding from the Healthy Ireland Fund and the Sláinte Care Fund delivered by Pubble.
Now, Ricky, our topic this week is one that I know is very close to your heart, particularly it's nest boxes for birds. Fascinating thing.
I've got a particular interest in swift nest boxes because they badly need them, and we'll get to that later in the show. But first, let's talk about garden birds and their needs and everything else. So birds need a couple of things. They need shelter to breed and build their nest and rear their young. They need food and they need a mate. So they're kind of the three prerequisites. So to help them along, we often provide them with nest boxes.
I have a very small back garden here in my house in County Wicklow, but I have on my back wall, I have a blue tit nest box that's used almost every year now. It's just sort of nestled in some ivy, and it's absolutely wonderful. I feel like I'm doing such a good thing for the birds when I see them coming in and out, and especially when you see them bringing in the food to the chicks, taking out those little fecal sacs, you know, the little, I suppose, disposable nappies they have coming out of the nest. It really does make you feel like, oh God, I really helped. They had nowhere near here to nest, and now they can, because I guess what we're doing, you know, in a more natural setting where humans hadn't altered the landscape so much, this wouldn't be necessary. There are plenty of nooks and crannies where birds could safely nest, but the fact is there are far fewer cavities around than there should be. We have very low tree cover, we don't have many dead trees around the place, so it's very hard for birds to find nesting spots. So a simple nest box can really make a big difference to them.
No, totally, and certainly in well maintained and I suppose modern gardens, they completely lack those natural opportunities. So, if you're in a rural setting or a farm, there's like the blue tit is a cavity nester. So throughout, before we start building sort of castles or any type of building, they would have nested in tree holes. And then when we start building castles and stuff out of stone, they would have found their ways into the walls and stuff. But in a modern city and town, there's very few of those cavities, suitable cavities. So we provide them with plywood boxes and we bolt them on trees and walls and stuff, and they love them. It's highly satisfying and it's really good to be able to provide that. So, you know, people can really do lots for the birds by feeding them all winter and then providing them with a safe nest site to nest in and rear young. It's really worthwhile doing.
When it comes to a typical garden, there's two main styles of nest box, I think, to look at. And the key is not to have too many of them. Maybe many gardens could only have one or two nest boxes. But it's good, I think, to have one with a small hole in the front of it. That's perfect for members of the tit family, sort of a classic nest box. And then open-fronted designs, which are used particularly by robins, but also by wagtails, even larger ones by blackbirds. They can work very well, too.
We recently produced guidance and DIY plans for templates for these boxes, just that, so which will accommodate a really large sort of cohort of garden birds. And like you say, there's different nest entrances, and that suits the niches and the styles of the birds and their behavior. So you mentioned there the what we call a tit nest box is with this round hole. Mm-hmm. And also house sparrow and tree sparrows even will nest in box with a round hole, and if the hole's big enough, starlings. And people get very, very uptight about the size of the hole. 28mm hole is for blue tits, and if it's any bigger, they won't go in. And 32 has to be for house sparrows and all that sort of stuff. But actually, the size of the hole dictates how small of a bird can get in rather than the type of bird. Like, a blue tit doesn't fly past a 28mm hole and go, oh, that house is for me. It can fit comfortably, whereas a starling can't get inside. So what you're really doing by putting a different size hole on the box is you're stopping a larger species get in. So, for example, if you have a 32mm size hole, a blue tit would happily go in there and a starling. So they could then compete for those boxes. So what you're really trying to do is provide a suitable one for each of the target species you want in your garden, I suppose. So, and the tits are really good examples. I got a load of boxes delivered to me a few years ago at the local men's shed in Port Laois. How are you, lads? Made loads of them and gifted them to me for different projects, and I had some left over, so I put them around our garden. We've quite a large garden, but one I didn't get to put up in time, and it was actually a starling box, and I left it on top of the oil burner, if you know those sort of metal boxes that's out in the backyard. Lo and behold, the great tits moved in anyway. They didn't care. And
oh, wow.
I've got a German Shepherd, Molly, and she can reach up there. So she got to know them quite a bit, and she'd stick her nose in the hole, but the male would come out and give it to Molly, give her a couple of pecks and fly off and come over and back. And it was quite funny. But if you build it, they will come, I suppose, is the point I make. They're deadly.
beggars can't be choosers. And the fact is that in the natural setting, the birds would take whatever most suitable cavity they can find, even if it's not perfect. So when it comes to nest boxes, I think, yeah, people can get too caught up in how they need to look. You're looking to meet some basic needs for the bird. And if your box meets those, then has a good chance of being used. So obviously, first of all, it has to be solid. It has to be, give them protection from predators and from the elements. So it drives me nuts. Sometimes you'll see, in some shops, you'll see people selling nest boxes made out of wicker or half coconut shells or things like this. They may be, you know, fine as garden ornaments, although even that's debatable. They're aesthetic though. The birds aren't interested in those. They're not dry and warm enough, not secure enough from predators. They really want a box, like a fortress that meets their needs. Ideally with a sloping roof so that any water that does fall, and let's face it, in an Irish summer, some water will fall. It'll drain off and won't go into the hole. I think it's very important too to have little drainage holes in the bottom of the box as well to allow it to dry when it does get damp. Put it in a good secure location. Certainly those tit style boxes with the holes in the front, they're more protected than an open box, so they can be more visible, more out in the open. For my robin nest box, I like to keep that tucked down behind a holly, sort of low, but keep it as a low bush. That offers protection from cats and from other predators, but still allows the birds to have easy enough access to it. And if you tick those boxes, if you pardon the expression, that tends to work. And maybe a couple of years before the birds get used to it. Sometimes they then do use them in the end, or sometimes they're so desperate for a nest site they'll go into it when you're just after putting it up on the wall or on the tree.
Absolutely. And the timber you use and stuff isn't like hugely important. You can use all scraps and get it together just so there's some sort of insulation value. So that's why we kind of shy away from kind of strange materials and plastics and things. So like plywood is great, and rough sawn larch and things you can get in any DIY shop is great. And of course, all the commercially available ones, certainly any that we were selling on Birdwatch Ireland website, will stand over, and we believe the designs are effective and everything else. So there's kind of a couple of styles, as you mentioned. So there's those tit style boxes with the holes in the front. There's the open fronted ones as well, and the robin box. Robins are well known to nest in sort of old wellies and teapots and all sorts of stuff. So they just want a large enough sort of vessel to build, because they've quite a big bulky nest made up of leaves and moss and grasses and all sorts of stuff. They just need that, and they like an open front, and like you say, quite low, and you could maybe hide it in a bit of ivy or something like that. The position can be important depending on the size of your garden. And as we said in an earlier episode about dawn chorus, robins aren't worried about where the blue tits are nesting in the garden, but they are worried about where the other robins are nesting. So if you've got a couple of robin nests or boxes really close together, and you've got two rival families competing for that territory, you could spell a bit of conflict for them, and it's not a good thing. And blue tits will definitely fight over cavities, as will grey tits. So if you have a small garden, just keep it maybe to one robin box and one tit box. And if you're in an urban setting, you might consider swift boxes. And I'll go into a bit of detail about swifts in a couple of minutes. But with a sheet of plywood, if you can get your sort of granddad on board or your dad or something, you could run off a pile of boxes and maybe gift them to people. Or if you have a big garden, you'll find a home for them, or even a farm. But the important thing is they're put up in the right place. And I've seen, certainly in farm settings, a load of boxes sort of bolted onto one tree just to sort of tick a box for their gloss payment and stuff. And I don't think that's sort of farmers being cynical. I just think that's farmers being very busy. The point I'm making is if you put them in the wrong place, they're not going to be used, because unless they're colonial species, starlings will all nest quite close together. So I wouldn't say a cluster, but in my garden, I have six starling boxes within, a couple of meters of each other, and they quite happily come and go. House sparrows are the same, and house sparrows will actually occupy any type of box. I've got those artificial house martin cups.
Oh, yeah.
On the barn, and I also have like 32 mil house sparrow nest boxes, two on the shed. And I also have a triple cavity swift box with kind of an apartment block for swifts on the shed. Of all those boxes, there's house sparrows in them all. So the house sparrows have just taken over all the designs. They don't care. They just want a space that they can squeeze into. So it goes back to that thing. If you build it, they will come. And don't get terribly frustrated if your target species doesn't move in. Just remember that you've provided for a family, and don't don't think sort of any species is less desirable than others.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we should try to get away from thinking we should control the natural world. You know, these things work themselves out. So, you know, we'll get, you mentioned there about the house martin nest cups, for example. House sparrows are well known for taking over the nests of house martins. What happens in those cases is that the house martins generally just go and build another nest somewhere else because they need to breed as well. It kind of tends to work itself out. You've got to remember as well that for the sparrows and for the other birds, nesting is the most important thing they will do in their whole lives. It's what their lives are all about. It's basically their job on Earth is to produce more of their own species, and then job done, and there's a new generation done there to replace them. And the nest boxes are a very important part of that, you know, making up for some of the lacking natural sites, as we were saying. I know that certainly, you know, when it comes to some other species, they will use nest boxes as well with special styles. So you mentioned there about the swift nest boxes, this triple cavity one. What's that about?
Putting up a nest box for a robin or a blue tit, you're not conserving a species that's sort of on its last sort of legs.
True.
But you're definitely providing a service for the birds. It's really nice and it's certainly a positive thing, and I'm not taken from that. But if you want to put up boxes that have really, really high level conservation value, barn owl boxes and swift boxes are definitely something to consider, depending on your circumstance and location. So swifts have lost their homes. We've basically built them out of our built infrastructure over the last 100 years. We've renovated buildings. The Celtic Tiger did them no good in the likes of Dublin and our other cities, where we've renovated old buildings and they nest in cavities. So they'll get into any crack and crevice under tiles, in where the mortar has fallen out between stones on buildings and stuff. And over time, and modern buildings and modern building materials, we don't allow those gaps anymore, and passive houses and all that sort of stuff is just a no-no. There's just no gaps and holes for swifts anymore. So there is people in Britain and Ireland on a crusade to get the nest sites, safe nest sites up for swifts, and they're a colonial bird. So we put up these apartment blocks, and that's what I mean by triple cavity. So you've got this kind of social housing for swifts. There's three apartments in each. Now you can get single ones depending on the circumstances, but they're just a row of nest boxes suitable for swifts, and the entrance is kind of an oval shape, and that's designed to try keep house sparrows out, even though a skinny house sparrow can get in. And it's more so to keep starlings out, because starlings do take over them quite a bit. But swifts really need homes especially in our urban areas, where we've made them homeless in the last 100 years. And great work by Swift Conservation Ireland, Wild Kildare, our own Kildare branch, West Cork branch, the Mead branch, Birdwatch Ireland Mead branch are getting on it now. There is swift boxes going up all over the country, and they're badly needed, and hopefully we can arrest the declines in nesting swifts. So it's kind of technical and it's kind of not, because there is an add-on that swifts are attracted where there's other swifts. So we play their lure, we play a call, we play this high pitch, and we'll play it now for you actually. So it's this kind of mad, shrill call that you just heard.
I love that sound. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we talked about Doran Chorus last week and non-pastorines and pastorines. So you wouldn't quite call it a song. It's quite shrill, but it is. In the urban landscape and urban soundscape, it really blends in. It's quite something.
And just on that, because we mentioned, harking back to the Dawn Chorus podcast that we did, we mentioned that duetting is very rare in European birds. The swift is one bird that does duet. The male calls or sings first and the female responds immediately. And so that's what you're hearing there. It's the pair collaborating on the song.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And it's a really good indication when they're really duetting like that, making that high pitch call, that they're very close to an S site. So if you can get these boxes up and play the lure, you can attract them in, because they're basically checking out. They think, oh, nice one. There's some of our own down here, and they'll check out the nest sites that you've provided and they'll move in. And another thing which is really clever, and we're moving towards more and more through the planning process and through lobbying and advocacy work, is swift bricks. And they're actually built into the like material of the wall. So if you can get if it's a new school, a new office block, a new apartment block, and you get to the architects and the planners and the engineers in advance, you can ask them to design in these bricks that are actually like a cavity, but it's like built into a brick with a hole that's external. So they go in to the fabric of the wall, they're plastered over, and you can see nothing from externally except the nest entrance. And if you Google those, you'll see them. It's a really tidy job, and architects much prefer to use those than sort of putting you know, retrospectively putting a big box on the outside of a building because it could take off the look. So they are super good thing to do. Not hugely expensive. They are specialised, but you can do DIY job, and DIY jobs work quite well too.
It's something, you know, when it comes to planning, this happens in some areas, and especially in some other European countries, it actually becomes part of the regulations of different local authorities that you have to have a certain number of swift bricks in certain buildings over a certain size. I think that's a really good one, because, you know, it's simple to do. There's no downside to having these birds around. You know, they're not interfering with anybody. They're very clean. It's not like they're leaving droppings all over the place or anything like that. It's wonderful to have them around. And this shows you where nest boxes can really, really help. Another really good example of that is a bird called the dipper, which is an aquatic bird. It's a songbird, but it plunges into the water, and it's always found around fast flowing rivers and streams. And their favorite nesting sites are often underneath bridges. And just like the way with modern buildings, they don't really allow much space for swifts, but a lot of modern bridges don't allow little ledges or nooks and crannies for these dippers to nest. So you can get a special design nest box for dippers, which works really well underneath a bridge. But also in some countries now, particularly in parts of Germany, when new bridges are being built, they have a special mold that they put into the concrete to actually make the shape of the space that the dipper needs to build its nest in. Really simple. There's no extra cost in doing that, and it makes a big difference for a species that really needs help.
Yeah, no, totally. That's ideal. And we've got perfect dipper streams, really fast flowing water, especially like over there in Wicklow where you are, loads of those. And Leash, where I'm at the foot of the Slieve Bloom Mountains, and a past colleague of ours, Alex Copeland, still does an awful lot of work on dippers around the Slieve Blooms and all its sort of myriad of streams, and he's put up hundreds of those nest boxes. And the key thing is they have to be over water, often put them under footbridges and bridges. But it's probably a good project for Tidy Towns together with Birdwatch Ireland branches, because it is a specialised job and it is over water. So there is an element of sort of risk and stuff to it. So I wouldn't be sort of encouraging everyone to sort of, you know, go down to the local river with the kids and bolt a dipper box to the underneath the bridge. But the key thing is the dipper nest is fantastic. It's like a giant wren's nest. It's this huge dome of moss. And the crazy thing is, you think about birds having to be warm and cozy and keep their feathers dry and all that. But if you ever visit a dipper's nest, which you shouldn't without a license, by the way, but I have had the pleasure of with Alex Copeland on many, many occasions. But like, it's sopping wet because the adult birds are coming and going, getting aquatic invertebrates from the fast flowing water and jumping back into the nest to feed young. So this ball of moss is just soaking in the bottom. And so it's really important to have drainage holes drilled into those. And there's loads of designs for those available on online as well. So I want to go back actually to Swifts before I forget. I was about to mention it. We produced a really, really good, robust Saving Swifts guidelines, and it's got designs for a really good proven Swift nest box design there. And we worked with all sorts of Swift experts and partners in the UK and Ireland to bring all that information together. So it's a really good booklet, and it's available on our website. If you just Google Saving Swift's Guide, you'll find it there.
Yeah, we're trying to make the Birdwatch Ireland website a real repository as well for a lot of this information about nest boxes. So we have a nest box FAQ there. We have some wonderfully produced DIY guides to nest box building as well that'll help you there. And also for bat box too, because that's an important thing to remember. So you'll find those at birdwatchireland.ie. One of my favourite designs though there, it's something you mentioned earlier, Ricky, it's the design for the barn owl nest box. Now our colleague John Lusby, who's Mr. Barn Owl, he's been using these a lot, and they can be really effective for a species that really needs our help.
Yeah, no, totally. And there's been an explosion of interest in barn owls over the last year. It's like, I don't know, people have just been reading stuff about them, and there's lots of stuff in the news. And I mean, John's out the door trying to sort of, you know, keep all the queries answered. But John produced a really, really excellent barn owl guide similar to the Saving Swifts one a couple of years previous. And that's also on our website. And that's got two key designs there. Barn owls, so called because they will nest in barns. And, you know, so old hay barns and stuff where once a year the hay would be stored and there would be little activity other than that. It would be full of rodents, mice and rats coming and going through the straw. So it's a perfect place for rodent eating species, and quiet and warm and everything. So traditionally barn owls across Europe would nest in barns. But I suppose as farms have become modern and slatted units and all that sort of stuff, and more machinery and coming and going and busier farms, we've kind of pushed them out a little bit. And also one of the other famous places they nest is in chimneys, in old cottages and old castles and stuff. So they still traditionally do, and John would spend a lot of time in old ruined castles and things. But We've probably, across our rural landscape, we've probably renovated and knocked a lot of the cottages and stuff that they would. So what John's trying to do, and other people, is replace those boxes or replace those nesting opportunities that are no longer naturally there for them. Maybe in tree holes and stuff like that. So there's two key designs. There's one indoor one for barns, and that's slightly different, and it's it doesn't have to be quite as robust because it's going inside and it's not getting weathered. And then the second one is this kind of triangular one. It's really, really robust, and that's for erecting it on maybe, mostly trees, big mature trees, but also I suppose you could put them externally on a ruin or some sort of other structure once it's suitable. And we have guidance for that in both John's booklet, and we produced a more up-to-date one as well. And the key advice there is, do not put them sort of near a busy road, because barn owls and kestrels and other raptors have a habit of hunting along the edges of roads, because what happens is the rodents make their way along the hedgerows, get to a busy road, and then they start sort of moving up and down, sort of following the flow of the road because they won't cross. So it brings a lot of barn owls and kestrels and stuff right up to the road and crossing the road looking for prey, and that's when cars and lorries and stuff get them. So if you're near a road, probably just stick to your blue tip boxes and your swifts and stuff. But if you're off the beaten track and you've got some suitable farmland and nice habitat around where there's plenty of mice and bits and pieces, consider putting up a barn owl box, because it's certainly conservation wise. And if you get to attract barn owls to your little bit of the world, you'll just be in awe. They're just super. They're magnificent.
Oh, yeah. Oh, who wouldn't want those? Here on the Wicklow coast, I rarely get to see barn owls. They're very thin on the ground in this part of the country. I think Munster is the main stronghold for them now. They are found nationwide, but we do get more reports and more nesting activity in Munster. I think it's important to point out too that we're talking about the birds that will use nest boxes. There are some other ones that will use quite niche design. So the tree creeper is a good example. You get this weird sort of wedge shaped, looks like a door wedge or something shaped nest box. The tree creepers will use if it's affixed to the bark of a trees. That's one that sort of people might want to be interested in. But of course, there's only a few species of birds that will actually use nest boxes. So there are many species that won't. So people, for example, would often contact us in Birdwatch Ireland and say, oh, there's some greenfinches or chaffinches in my garden at the moment. I want to put up a nest box. What will they use? Well, they won't. They don't nest in nest boxes. They'll nest inside a hedge or inside some other dense vegetation. So another important part of providing nesting habitats in addition to your nest boxes is making sure that you can have like dense hedgerows or dense bushes where other birds that won't use the nest boxes will find safe places to raise their broods.
That's such a key point. Like the best nest site for any bird is a natural one. So I'm not saying go and build a castle ruin for a barn owl, but if you can get a bit of hedge, bit of new hedgerow into the garden, or just leave a corner of the garden to go wild. Bramble is brilliant as well. Of the various areas I've left wild in our garden, the bramble is coming down with sort of Dunnock nests, wren's nests, you name it. There's robins in there. I don't know, the house sparrows spend a lot of time in there, but I don't think they nest in there. I don't know. Black cap's in there as well. So it's deadly, yeah. So you just cannot replace the natural sort of, places for them. I want to ask, Niall, yes. You will know in great detail, people always ask, it's one of the things we get queried about all the time, is cleaning out nest boxes.
Oh, yes. So cleaning out nest boxes. So people ask, should they do it? Should they not do it? How should they handle it? I usually think in general, something like a blue tit nest box, cleaning it out is a good idea. In a natural setting, obviously, this wouldn't happen and the birds will make do. But nesting material, it does get infested with little parasites, ticks and fleas and also things like bacteria. And it's, if we can help the birds to not have to deal with those, then so much the better. So lots of nest boxes commercially, and also the designs we have on our website, allow for a little hinged lid or a hinged side where you can open those up. Never do that while the birds are actually nesting, because it really is very frightening for them. It can actually cause them to abandon their nest. They don't know that you don't mean them any harm. They just see this big pair of eyes from some predatory mammal looking in and they panic. But once the nesting season is over, usually in the autumn time is a safe time to do this, just open that little panel or lid or whatever, and then using a rubber glove and just take out that nesting material. It usually comes out in one piece because it's so well woven together. The reason you wear a rubber glove is because, yeah, it has these little ticks and fleas and things in it. They're not dangerous to humans. They have no interest in humans, but still, you know, best not to have them on your skin. Throw that into your compost heap or into the brown bin, and then you can clean the box out. Now, the way that I clean my nest box out every year is I leave it up on the wall, and I don't like to use chemicals. There are certain chemicals you can use. Mild bleach solution can help, but actually a kettle full of boiling water does the job brilliantly. Just boil the water, pour through while it's still just off the boil, let it soak into the wood of the box, and then let it air dry. That'll kill off any of the nasties that are lurking in the wood, and then it'll leave it nice and sanitized for the birds to use later in the season. Now, they won't nest in it until the following breeding season, the next spring or summer. But what will happen during the winter is you will get some birds will actually use that to roost in, so to sleep in overnight. And that can be a real lifeline for several species on cold winter nights. And it's interesting, one bird that often does that is the wren. And what they'll do is, when it's very cold, they'll actually gather together in groups, in a ball inside a nest box, huddling together for warmth. And I remember something mind-blowing I saw. I think the record was set in England a few years ago. In a standard blue tit-sized nest box, you know, the design for blue tits, someone counted 65 wrens in a ball inside that nest, all just huddled up together for warmth.
That's nuts. They are small, but 65 wrens would be a good lump.
Yeah, a good lump of wrens. Yeah, that may be the collective noun for them. You know, a lump of wrens. So actually, you know, cleaning out the nest box in the autumn time before the weather gets too bad, that can actually help some of these birds that would roost in them. Got quite a few reports this past winter of great tits sleeping in nest boxes on the very cold winter nights, and blue tits as well. So worth doing. You can give them an extra boost, and means that your nest box is doing extra good for the birds.
Definitely. I think that sort of wraps up everything about people need to know, and there's just lots of detail on our website. I just want to give a couple of warnings again, is that please do, the temptation is massive to lift the lid and look in at the chickies and see what's going on and if they're still incubating and all that sort of stuff, but please resist that temptation. There are specialised boxes that have little cameras that you can link back to the TV and stuff like that, so use those. It's because it's away from, you know, you're not disturbing the birds. What you don't want to do is be putting up boxes for birds and then disturb them to the point where they just abandon. It's bad news. The other thing about taking the nest material out, you'll have a nice little nest. You often get this eruption of nest mites and stuff, and they're just gross. And I wouldn't be sort of giving it to my 4-year-old to go into school with the nature tail, because you'll just infest the class. So the best thing probably to do is to take out the nest and leave it sit somewhere like in the woodshed for a couple of months for just those to vacate, and then use it for the nature table or for whatever to study yourself later on down the road. And of course, just never touch a nest during the breeding season. Even if you think it's empty or abandoned, it may well not be, because they could be still building it. Often they don't line them till they're about to lay eggs and stuff. So just don't touch nests. It's just a bad idea, and it's illegal anyway. But try your refrain.
I think that, you know, sometimes people misunderstand that they might peek into the blue tit box or whatever, or the robin's nest in the hedge or whatever, and what they see mum or dad there in with the chicks, and what happens is they stay very, very still. So people think, oh, I'm not bothering this bird, because they expect the response they would get from a mammal, you know, sort of snapping and snarling and baring a teeth. But birds show their stress in a very different way. They remain very, very quiet and very, very calm, but in fact their heart rate is massively increased, and you know, they could very easily decide, my nest site has been compromised here, this predator has found out where I am, you know, my chicks are doomed anyway, I may as well cut my losses, go start a new nest elsewhere and leave them. And that's what they'll do.
No, that brings us a nice natural conclusion there. So let's go to my favourite and only feature of our podcast. the bird of the week. We try link the bird of the week to the episode. So talking about nest boxes, we can't overlook the blue tit, and we've mentioned them already. So I just want to sort of introduce the blue tit, because I know you're just going to go off on a tangent and tell us all about them. They are smaller than a robin, a nice little bundle of blue, and so-called. They're amazing. They're found in most gardens, I would say, of any size. Mm-hmm. They're cavity nesters, so they will readily come to nest boxes and gaps in walls and under tiles and all sorts of sort of spaces like that. They're aggro, though. They're like real little sort of aggro dudes, and they're quite aggressive. And that's what I like about them. I like a bit of character and a bit of spine in a bird, you know. But there's a couple of interesting things, and I know I'll let you sort of go into detail about them. But the synchronicity I want you to talk about of their season and the nesting. And the other thing I want you to talk about is the spectrum of blue and what the females see when they see a male blue tit.
I think the blue tit is an excellent choice for bird of the week because it's a bird that all of us could see today if we want to go out and try find one. They're very common. There's 1.1 million pairs of them nesting here in Ireland. First of all, I think nobody would bear any ill will towards a blue tit, but I think sometimes familiarity can breed, if not contempt, then ambivalence, because we take them for granted. A lot of people say to me, they say, oh, you know, we're so hard done by here in Ireland. All our birds are so drab and boring. We're not like the tropical rainforest. Well, first of all, I tell you that if you look at any field guide to the birds of Brazil or Peru or anything, they have more than their fair share of drab brown things that skulk on the forest floor. But the fact is, we're forgetting the fact that a blue tit, it's this bright blue, yellow and green gem. It's absolutely stunning. We also, of course, have things like kingfishers and great tits and chaffinches. Stunning, stunning birds. But the blue tit, if it was rare, we'd value it so much. It's something, you know, like we'd absolutely love it. The fact we have them all in our gardens, we get used to them. Perhaps we don't value them the way that we should. I think they really are fascinating birds. And you mentioned there about the how they synchronize their nesting with the emergence of caterpillars. I think that's a really important point, because one of the problems is that this is something that's kind of going out of kilter a bit. Climate change may threaten this species. We have to be aware that you know, a bird that's really common now may not always be common, because there are many birds like the yellowhammer or the corn bunting, for example, that were once really common and no longer are. Blue tits' lives revolve around caterpillars, and that's actually how they get the colour in their feathers. I'll talk a bit more about the colour on blue tits in a moment, but the yellow colour on them comes from the vegetation in the guts of the caterpillars. They need to eat lots of them and need to feed them to their chicks. So in the breeding season, for let's say the 2.5 weeks or so that those young blue tits are in the nest, they grow very rapidly. Their parents have to find about 10,000 caterpillars in order to feed them in just that small period of time. Now, as I said, there's 1.1 million pairs of them nesting simultaneously.
These are moth caterpillars, I think. Because
yes, they're mainly moth caterpillars. That's right.
Yeah. Because I think people who don't, I think people, most people associate caterpillars with butterflies, but there's a profusion of moth species, much more than butterflies in Ireland, with these tiny green indescript caterpillars that you'd walk straight past and in 100% of cases, really. But that's what the blue tits are after.
That's what they do. That's what they're after, absolutely. And you know, it's always a bit of a bugbear of mine. If you ask a small kid, like, what does a caterpillar grow into? And they say, a butterfly. Yeah, a small number of them do. But as you said, the vast majority of caterpillars we encounter are moth caterpillars. And so what happens is that the blue tits have to time their breeding season for the peak availability of those caterpillars. That's all controlled by things like day length and temperature and so on. However, it's been going out of kilter a little bit, because what's happening is that some of these moth caterpillars have been emerging from their eggs earlier than they would have a few decades ago, probably because of climate change, almost certainly. And the fact is that the blue tits haven't necessarily been able to adapt to that change as rapidly as they need to. And so actually the provision of food is a bit less than it used to be. Now, the species remains very common. Blue tits are doing very well in Ireland, but it just shows why it's important for us in Birdwatch Ireland to monitor our common birds. So the Irish Garden Bird Survey tells us a lot about our blue tit populations and other common birds. As a conservation charity, people often think that we would only be really interested in monitoring rare birds. And of course we do that, but you can tell a lot more about changes in the environment by monitoring the common birds. It's a really important thing to do. So that's you know, that synchronicity between the caterpillars and the blue tit nesting is a really important thing to bear in mind. And you can also help them with that by putting plants in your garden, especially native plants that will support the caterpillars of those moths and some of the butterflies that they'll eat as well. That's a great way to help those caterpillars and therefore help the blue tits. And of course, having blue tits in your garden, it's a great way to control all sorts of pests too, because they'll eat all sorts of things, all the insects that are going for your roses or whatever, they'll eat those as well.
Before you talk about the colour spectrum, let's just play their song. Lovely job.
There's a personality there.
There's a nice solid pattern there as well, and they're quite consistent. So if you learn that, you'll start picking up blue tits all over the place, especially in the spring and the breeding season. Tell us. Let's wrap up with this blue spectrum thing. It's a It's quite interesting.
One of the things I find most fascinating about blue tits are their colours. I mean, obviously they're very beautiful, but there's a lot of things going on in their feathers that tell us a lot about how birds produce colour plumage. So I won't get too technical with it. But the fact is, first of all, they have white on them, which is an absence of pigmentation. They have that on their faces. And the way to distinguish them from a grey tit or a coal tit, even if at a distance, is that they have white above their eye. They have a dark line going through their eye, but white above that. Their other relatives, the grey tit and the coal tit, have dark heads with white cheek patches, and the coal tit is white on the back of the head, but there's no white above the eye. So that's produced by an absence of pigment. They have yellow on their chests, and that is produced by the pigmentation that's in the vegetation in the guts of the caterpillars that they eat. They can't produce it naturally. Birds can't naturally produce reds and yellows. They get that from their diet. The blue they have on their bodies, that's actually produced by a trick of the light. There's not pigmentation, it's not from their food. It's microstructures in the surface of their feathers that reflect light in the blue wavelength. And that's how that is produced. The green that's on their backs is a combination of that reflected blue light with the underlying green, yellow pigmentation that comes from the caterpillar stomachs. And that's how they produce that. But then again, they have yet another colour that we humans can't see. And this is the most...
Hold on. Take a breath. Jenny Mac, hold on. I need a breath here. Okay. Go ahead.
Grandson. So the color that they produce in their feathers that we can't see is ultraviolet. Now, when you see on television, they have like ultraviolet, you know, technology cameras, they show it as being like a glowing light. That's not what it looks like. That's just something that technology is rendering so the human eye can see it. Ultraviolet, essentially, is a color like any other that we humans just can't see. But most birds can. And to them, it's a colour like any other, like blue or red or yellow. It looks no different, you know, it's just a colour. They take it for granted. In the same way, of course, though, that you would mix, let's say, blue and yellow to make green. If you mix blue and ultraviolet, presumably that makes yet another colour that we humans can't even conceive of. And to us, you might be wondering, why is this important for blue tits? Well, to the human eye, male and female blue tits look pretty much identical. They're extremely similar. The males, however, have a big patch of ultraviolet on their heads that the females don't have. So at a glance, they can easily tell who's male and who's female. They look very different to each other. To us humans, though, we find it much harder. So I love to think about that. We humans sometimes think, you know, we're the ultimate creature. You know, we're so superior. But in fact, to most birds, the world is so much more colourful than we can even conceive of. So there's a hidden world that blue tits can see that we can't. And I love
it's
that.
It's basically the equivalent of me and you both going out in Dublin and me having a can of Lynx on and you not.
That's a wonderful way to put it, absolutely. As far as birds are concerned, all humans are to a degree colorblind. We're missing a color that they can't see. Now, in terms of mammals, we have very good color vision. You know, we're primates. Primates have good color vision. Most mammals have very bad color vision, but the birds leave us in the dust.
Cool. No, we'll definitely, and we'd have to revisit that because that is just so interesting. I think that brings us to a nice conclusion. Really enjoyed that episode. So in summary, nest boxes. Birds need them to nest. Swifts and barn owls, dippers and birds that actually are losing their natural nest sites need them more than anyone. But definitely put them up for the more general species in your garden and you'll get loads of enjoyment out of those. And you can find them in our shop at birdwatchireland.ie. You'll find everything you need. And we have two special pages. We've Garden Birds, which has a Q&A or a frequently asked questions about nest boxes and cleaning them out and where to put them and stuff. And we also have a new page with loads of DIY plans and other information about where to install the boxes and stuff. So you'll get all that there in great detail.
Also then at birdwatchireland.ie, that's where you'll find details of our membership as well. So, you know, if you like birds and you want to help us to help them, please join. We really need your support. So you'll find full details of membership at birdwatchireland.ie as well.
So thanks for listening. Our next episode is on buzzards and we're really looking forward to that, getting our teeth into our first bird of prey proper. Hope you enjoyed it and talk to you next time. This podcast is brought to you by Birdwatch Ireland, Leashing Off the County Councils and the Keep Well campaign, an initiative of the Government of Ireland with funding from the Healthy Ireland Fund and the Sláintecare Fund delivered by Pubble. The In Your Nature podcast is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly.